thank you, everybody, for joining us on this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry. We've got a repeat, retread, recycled guest, Jim Irwin from Shooting Performance Institute, on the line. Jim was on the show last year with us. You are the rifle guy, the long-range shooting guy down there in Douglas County, and I'd be willing to bet probably in the state. For anybody that wants to, you can go look up Jim's background on his website. I won't bore you with that stuff. Jim, what's the website real quick?
Okay, the website is shootingperformanceinstitute.com, and it's got, like I said, our background on there, training products that we sell and endorse. But yeah, that's where you can find us.
Okay, so I won't go through the military accolades, but I did want to bring up your exploits in the backcountry served as the real-life inspiration for the blockbuster hit movie Brokeback Mountain, right?
Yeah, it actually was, and I'm still waiting on my royalties from that.
Yeah. You got to get your agent involved, man.
No doubt. If you could get the royalties, go ahead, call it whatever you like.
I had to pretend to be a Navy guy for that part.
Oh, 100%, man. Oh, hair gel and abs, yeah.
Oh, I had to throw the jab.
All right, so that's a joke I would not. Anybody that's met Jim knows, what are you, like 6'3", 250?
Yeah, right about there.
Yeah, so that's not a joke I would make to Jim's face if he were in here in studio. But no, man, sincerely, thank you for coming back on the show. Why don't you give us a rundown? Where do you want to start? Your trip to Africa?
We ended up taking a trip to Africa. It's been one of those dream hunts we've been wanting to do. And I say we as my wife and I. We actually took a couple friends with us, one being her dad, who went along. He wanted to check it out. It turned out to be just a phenomenal about 17 days. From here, we drove down to San Francisco, caught a plane in San Francisco, flew to Paris, which was about 11 hours. Any of you guys ever thinking about doing that, pay the extra money to get that business class level, because if you're my size, getting stuffed in the cattle car in the back is brutal for that long. Had a little layover there, and then another 11-hour flight into Johannesburg. Six-hour layover, 22 hours of flying. It takes a little bit to get through customs because, like I said, we brought our own rifles and ammo, and there was a bunch of paperwork to do ahead of time. But once you're there and that stuff's established, there's a company that we use that linked up with us there to make sure everything got through customs fine, got our stuff, and then we were supposed to catch a plane. We got in about 8:30 in the morning. We were going to catch a plane to Tete, Mozambique, for Annalisa's croc hunt. She wanted to do a croc, so we set that up. And to do that, what she was after, we had to go to Mozambique. So we're going to catch a plane that afternoon, and lo and behold, the ammo for her rifle didn't show up.
Oh!
And I'm like, well, I've got my 300 Norma ammo. No, it's because she has a custom load for her gun. And so anyway, we ended up having to stay the night, wait for that same plane to arrive the next day. And then we had a 10 a.m. flight. So we got that stuff at 8:30 coming off the plane at like 9:30. We finally got our hands on it, and we're sprinting to get through the customs and go to Mozambique. And that turned into a little chaos. Kind of a cool thing over there is when you got friends that are ahead of you, they're like just loitering and delaying things for us on the back end, not getting on the plane quite yet. So we got on there, a few hours flight into Tete, Mozambique, and then had about a five-hour drive into what they call the fly camp. From Tete to Lake Cahorabasa, and then we had about a three-hour boat ride over the lake to where we would actually hunt. So one of the – it was a lot of comedy, I guess you could say, if we had to call it that, because it's just what it was, without getting pissed off. So when we get into Tete, remember, we grabbed that ammo and just sprinted for it. Well, we had to do paperwork on everything we were taking, and we said we were bringing 40 rounds of ammo. Well, there was 80 rounds in there, 6.5 PRC and her 300 Norma ammo. So we landed in Tete, and they're like – what's this? This paperwork says 40 rounds. There's 80. I'm like, that's different. You know, what happened was, our outfit that was there, awesome dudes, Kabasa Safaris, is like, hey, I'll talk to him. You guys go over there. And about 20 minutes later, he comes back and he's like, yeah, we're good. I'm like, oh yeah. He's like, yeah, $20. We're good.
Hey, so if I could interject for a second, I would echo the sentiments about business class. The last time I went to Africa, it's funny, the same thing, they lost our guns. And fortunately, on the way home, we were able to leverage that, but we basically, we got them to pony up for that coming back. Holy The difference between the flight over in like the cattle car, as Jim called it, versus coming back where it's like my seat reclines into a bed. I got people bringing me champagne. Night and day difference. That's the only way to travel.
Yeah. Because I'm, as Jim's talking about all of this, I'm calculating, you know, he's like 11 hours here, 6 hour layover, 11 hours here, 3 hours here, 5 hours. And I'm like, that's 39 hours of travel. When we fly back to New York on occasion to see family, I go bonkers. I'm like, okay, this flight's from here to there is going to be
that east direction, and then travel in between.
Oh, God.
And then on the boat ride, that was really cool. We finally got it. She ended up with about a 13.5-foot croc. It was pretty fantastic, especially when you're talking trophy-level stuff. If you've ever hunted at gators in America, you know, you shoot them, you know, basically right behind the eye in the ear hole. That's where you're looking to shoot. So your area of opportunity to make a good kill on it is extremely small. And then you typically explode the head. Well, when you're talking a trophy of that magnitude and the cost and getting over there and the price of it and everything, you don't want to explode the head. That's part of the trophy. So
yeah,
shot behind, for lack of a better term, behind the smile when it opens the croc opens her mouth. We got ours. He was sunbathing on a little island, you know, laying out. And when they open their mouth, it creates that little V, you know, right behind the smile. You go back a couple inches, and you're looking to sever the spine so they can't take off on you.
Gotcha.
And immediately followed up with a shot through the lungs. And so you've got an inch or two of shot placement to make sure it doesn't go anywhere, because if it goes in that water, they pretty much tell you, well, yeah, we're not going in for it. That's for sure. There's thousands of crocs in there.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, me either, dude. Yeah. Understood. So she just dead nuts nailed it, followed up with a second shot, sub 5 seconds through the lungs, and we were all high-fiving, celebrating. I almost cried. You know, very emotional moment for me and the missus taking big trophy.
Was that with the 6.5 PRC?
She hit that with a 300 Norma.
Oh, that was the 300 Norma. Okay.
Yep. We took a 6.5 PRC and did some hunting with that. And a 300 PRC. We actually took four rifles, two being Normas, one 300 PRC, one 6.5 PRC. So after all that, and our trip got cut short a little bit there because of the delay. We basically, the next day, back on the boat, back across the lake, drove back in. But actually, on the way in, you know, after the bribery, if you will, the negotiations at the customs and tets, we freaking get in the cars and we start heading up the road. And they're like, yeah, there's checkpoints here and there. And you got to have like a road guard vest or, you know, like a high vis vest. And you got to have a fire extinguisher and this and that. And we drive up the road and it's like a mining area up there. So the roads are trashed. Like they're paved, but they're not paved. So you're not getting any speed. And look up the road and there's a guy like in just like a blue outfit. And they're like, oh, that's a cop. And then he waves us down. There's like a stick in the road. There's our checkpoint. He asks our driver, you know, hey, you got your fire extinguisher, this and that. And he did, and everything's good to go. And my driver, you know, is looking at him like, so can we go? He's like, well, do you have any money? He's like, no, I've got cold drinks. He's like, okay, what do you got? He's like, well, I've got this Pepsi or I've got beer. So on video, we filmed the entire hunt from the time we landed till we got back on a plane. And so on film, we have our driver and this cop like sharing, drinking a beer together, hanging out on the road. It's like, and they were off again. Different world, different ways of doing business. So.
Was the rest of the hunting in Mozambique, or did you guys go somewhere else?
So we hopped back on a plane, drove back down to Tet, hopped back on a plane to Johannesburg, and it was the first time it had snowed in Johannesburg in, like, decades, and we land when it was snowing in July and going into their winter there. So we land, and then we basically hunted, spent the night Johannesburg, and then drove down to Free State, Central South Africa, hunted there for a few days, and basically worked ourselves all the way down to Eastern Cape. Kudu, Gemsbok, Nyala, Reedbuck, Golden Wildebeest, Zebra. Felt bad about the zebra. It was smaller than I thought, like, in my mind. I thought, gosh, I shot a pony.
Now, like, with the zebras there, I didn't realize that there's, like, four different subspecies of zebra.
Yeah.
And it all depends on their stripe configuration. There's a certain zebra that's like, yeah, this one's just a pest. You can harvest this one for $500, but this other one's a really tough one to find, and that one's 10 grand.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, not doing the 10 grand. There's like size differences.
No.
So you have your black and your white, and there will be shadowing in between those stripes and the white. some are clean, different species, and then some have a shadowing. And I believe ours had a little bit of the shadowing. It was not the, I can't remember. Like I said, there's four different species, and we were just going bonkers out there.
Hate to cut you off, Jim. We got to take a quick commercial break here. Thank you to Legacy Sports International, home of the Howa Superlight, for sponsoring the show. When we come back, we'll get into some of the firearms used on the hunt in Africa. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. If you're just joining us, the show is Nevada Backcountry. Special guest today is Jim Irwin from Shooting Performance Institute down there in Gardnerville. We're just chatting a little bit about Jim's trip last year to Africa. Jim, you mentioned a 300 Norma, a 6.5 PRC. You said a 300 PRC. What was the fourth gun you guys took with you?
We had two 300 Normas that we'd taken. We got two custom builds from... or I shouldn't say custom, but like full builds from Proof Research prior to going. And I want to, you know, shout out to those guys. They've been a sponsor of mine since like 2012 and been always a huge advocate of us and supporting us. So they built us two rifles to take on the trip, one being a 300 PRC, one being a 300 Norma.
Let me stop you there real quick, if I could. What's 300 Norma?
The 300 Norma is by far our favorite round. It is an absolute monster of a round. So think 300 Win Mag, but a longer bullet, not a belted case. So we go, say, into the 300 PRC realm.
Okay.
Straight wall casing, longer bullets, higher ballistic coefficients, meaning these projectiles fly extremely well, defeat the environmentals really well, so we get a lot of distance out of them. So then we take that same exact projectile and we basically put it in a 338 Lapua casing. So we're throwing that thing around 34 to 3,500 feet per second, and it's stable.
Whoa.
So it's a 2 mile gun.
When you say that, I think of the like a 300 Rum.
This thing, if you put all the casings next to each other, it's like here's a walrus, here's a walrus, here's a great white.
Yeah. Like okay.
Size difference. If you take that middle picture, and then here comes the great white, like right over the top of them. It's like the casing, the amount of propellant that we're putting behind that thing is a lot more to push that speed. And in the long range hunting game, or in the long range game, you know, speed goes a long way. And if you can keep it stable at those speeds, you have a lights out shooting gun that's extremely predictable through 1,000 yards, any hunting area distances, like ethical hunting distance you could think of. For us, if we can get prone, an 800-yard shot, honestly, is like, it's a sub-1-inch group. But we shoot all the time, train with them. We know our ballistics and stuff. So I'm not saying just the layman could go out there, grab this gun, and the bullet will do it all day. You got to be able to put the mechanics behind it as well.
So when we're talking PRC, Grindle, what that really refers to is actually the casing itself and the specifics of the casing for that round.
Overall length differences. I'm not a hand loader or anything. I won't pretend to be on that. But when you put them side by side, you can see physical size difference. Like, say, even like a 300 Win, you know, if you paint the picture, like if you put it there, it's got like that little 1 inch of, say, for example, like or 3/4 of an inch of the bullet. It looks like a little stubby, right?
Yeah.
There's still projectile down in the casing. And then when you put it next to like a 300 PRC or a 300 Norma projectile, you're about 1.5 inch length. You see much more of the bullet. You can see the big, you know, pointy taper on it. Ballistically, it's a better flying bullet.
How many grains of powder are you running in that? I mean, I know you said you don't hand load, but do you know off the top of your head what the case capacity is?
I don't.
Okay.
Hornady's kind of leading the charge on this with the PRC rounds, precision rifle cartridge, and getting just excellent results on it. They're able to push it faster. So when you get into the PRCs, if you keep it fairly generic, you know, so it makes sense at our level, not the Uber hand loader guys. And I got buddies that do that stuff, and they'll listen to this and be like, that nerd doesn't know. Hey, I don't, but I shoot the hell out of them, and I know what they do performance-wise.
Yeah,
I might not know exactly what it's doing at distance. You start looking at those, and it's just – the precision rifle cartridge, they've done basically that, taking some of those older, like, or kind of wildcat rounds back then, modern metallurgy and ballistics, how they're able to stabilize bullets now on shape, form, how they machine the bullets, all this has taken us to the next level of not necessarily needing a gunsmith to spend days on a load ladder or workup and give you a very high-performing bullet. When we first got our first 300 Norma, that monster, which started spoiling us, I'm like, well, shoot, that's cool. That's a cool round. We shot at a SHOT Show years ago. Proof's like, yeah, we'll build you one. And I'm like, okay, I'll start buying some ammo for it. It didn't exist. Half the handload for it. So we did that. Fast forward, years later, come to, present, and I find some burger box ammo probably a month before Proof got us the rifle. And I'm like, I'll just try these burger bullets in here and just see if it can be pretty good. And then I shot four rounds to basically get it zeroed. The next three rounds were .198, so sub-quarter inch group.
Whoa!
Ran down, took a picture of it, came back, showed the guys, and then put another round right through that hole. So I had a four-round group, sub-quarter inch, brand-new rifle, box ammo. I mean, so...
I'm familiar with Proof's barrels. What kind of action are they building on?
So they use Defiance actions on most of their stuff. I think all the ones I have are Defiance actions, Proof barrels. The stocks are carbon fiber Proof stocks. You can't buy a Proof stock to put on something else. They are very proprietary to them and their builds. And they only build maybe a couple hundred full rifles a year, last I heard.
Yeah. How many Proof rifles have you got now?
Five
of them? Okay.
We love them. And we do some, and anytime we build something else, say if we're using like a AG composite stock or like a Falcor action or something, it's always a Proof barrel on there just because they perform so well. They've cracked the code on those. The carbon fiber barrels dissipate heat like 60% faster. They're 40% lighter, and carbon fiber actually tightens as it gets hotter. So we get performance over longer periods of time with repeated shots. So say if you're doing a fast three rounds or four rounds, the Proof barrel doesn't move as opposed to a thinner steel barrel that will start to heat up and your shock group opens up.
Dave and I were out at the gun range. Dave's got an antelope hunt coming up. And I, of course, I dragged out my Model 70 Featherweight Classic in 270.
Yeah,
and so we're
great.
Shooting that. But man, you're absolutely right. That thin barrel, when you're ringing steel for fun, it heats up pretty dang quick and starts moving on you, especially with a wood stock.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are... Traditionally, this heritage type rifle with the wooden stock, pencil type barrels, 20, 22 inch ones, like the mountain gun, if you will.
Yeah.
We've transcended that. It was just through modern technology and materials, carbon fiber, even in our stocks, right? It's a very, very strong, almost impossible to break, right? Resistant to cold, heat, humidity, moisture, all this other stuff. And then you throw a carbon fiber wrapped barrel in there. I had a 28 Nosler. I actually just sold it to a kid here locally with a titanium action on it, too. So mountain-type gun, pushing, I think we were gauging that one at like almost 3,200 feet per second, just an absolute laser beam with a 180-gram bullet, right? So all this, like, we're using titanium, we're using carbon fiber, we've gone away from the plastics or the wood or the, you can still get these, like a polymer, if you want, or fiberglass stocks, but man. We've come so far to be able to build a lightweight gun, but when we go back into those lightweight pencil barrels for that mountain gun, you have to be able to manage expectations of you and your equipment. That's how I start my training. And we teach these intro to long range classes is bring what you got. We're going to show you how to use it on a hunt, but you have to understand that the capability of this gun is about three rounds because of its build, its design. If you don't hit those first two shots, the third one's going to be a mystery event because the barrel, if it's in quick succession, that barrel's not going to be able to handle it and keep it grouping.
That's a good way to put that mystery event.
That was good.
Beyond two rounds, it's a mystery event.
Yeah. Where'd who go? Because you just don't know what it's going to do. You've changed, for lack of a better term, that metallurgy of the harmonics of that barrel because now it is hot, especially if you're running like these Ultra Mags, these PRC rounds. It'll start changing dynamics of the gun quickly because they superheat very quick.
Yeah.
And we find, especially 6.5 Creeds and our 6.5 TRCs, carbon fiber barrels, you get so much more time, if you will. You get that, it's forgiving, right? If I end up missing and I got to send a couple more rounds quickly, it's going to print right where it was.
I love that gun, that 6.5 Creedmoor Proof barrel on there. I mean, it's a ton of fun to go out and ring steel at 1,000 yards with that thing.
Oh, absolutely.
But I also, I don't want to hunt. I'm not 6'3", 250 pounds. I don't want to hunt with a 12-pound rifle or whatever the heck it is. So I got to be honest, you may have transcended those old school guns, Jim. I still like my Model 70s and 270.
Well, I'm gonna have to burst your bubble, bro, because my 120-pound rifle carries her 12-pound rifle all over this place.
Yeah, oh. I met Annalise, though. You can burst that bubble. All, yeah, I'm not taking that action, dude. Yeah, I don't want to get choked out in a parking lot.
Does. Well, it's, there's a balance, right, of forgiveness. And we talk about it in our classes, too. It's like, you know, how much are you willing to sacrifice on weight, right? Because ounces equal pounds, pounds equal pain on the mountain. But there's also what it gives me for capability. So we talk a lot about that. What can I get away with, but what am I willing to sacrifice? So, like, we use some pretty sturdy bipods. Our rifles are a little heavier because one of the things I see sacrificed immediately on lightweight guns, and if you're not a student of the gun and your body position is not right, when you fire that first round and it jumps and it comes off target and you can't see impact, you're right back to that mystery event. And lightweight guns are famous for doing that. You send a shot, and you're like, did I hit it? That should never be a question coming out of your mouth. Did I hit it? I don't know. Because we want to be able to see that round make impact or the miss to make a quick adjustment on it, a correction, and send us a follow-up shot to make that ethical hit.
On that note, I got a couple questions when we come back after the break, specifically about some of those long-range shooting courses you teach. Don't go anywhere. Refill the coffee. We will be back momentarily on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Hey, thank you, everybody, for rejoining us. Third segment of the show here. We've got a special guest today, Jim Irwin from Shooting Performance Institute. Jim, where we left off there, you started to get into some of those lightweight rifle jumping around on you. You mentioned your shooting courses. Do you have anything coming up for people listening right now that have a tag in their pocket and maybe want to get tuned up before they hit the hills this fall?
We just finished our last class before antelope season. Was literally last weekend. It's a 2-day class, intro to long ranger, and it was, as we applied, it's into the hunting field to be able to understand what you're capable of doing, what your weapons are capable of doing out to a given distance. We proof out guns to 1,000 yards, so meaning we're giving you the opportunity to shoot to 1,000 yards. Depending on your rifle, we can go to a mile. But the class is designed to get you on the right path to understanding how we achieve high probability of first round hit, right? And making the shot count, hit ethical shots, put it in the vitals. And we start from, you know, ground zero, how to manage expectations of you or yourself and your equipment. And if you got your grandpa's old, you know, Model 70 or yours.
Yeah, or mine.
Yeah, that is a phenomenal gun, and that cartridge has, depending on that caliber, excuse me, but those types of guns have fed families for decades. It doesn't mean you need a sniper rifle to do what we do, but you need to know or be able to manage the expectations of you and your equipment. How far is far for you and your rifle, right, and your caliber, making sure we got the good ballistics to ethically harvest. And then we get into the position, scope setup, rifle setup, how we're getting this data. So when you hit the mountains or these open lands out here, you know how far it is and what you need to put on the gun to make that shot count. And we'll get you to 1,000 yards. We've done it with ARs, you know, .223 rifles, and gotten guys to 1,000 yards. Just blow their mind. But I've also have guys come out and they're like, I'm content with just getting to 500. That's all the information I want. I'll never go beyond that. Hey, awesome. We're going to show you what you can do with that rifle, right? So that's our intro class. We do a positional shooting course, too, to replicate or simulate shots you might find yourself on a hunt, whether it's off a rock outcrop, off a shooting six, side slope, standing, using tripods. And that's a one-day course that we do that on. And then we every year we also do this thing we call Hunter's Challenge. So we develop this four-stage course, and there's four targets at each stage. We get two shots on each target. 8 minutes to do it, and this is where we start seeing some of those barrel phenomena happening.
Yeah,
because you got 8 minutes to shoot 8 rounds, and they start getting hot and wonky. And so instead of just steel out there, we actually use this company out back east called Life Size Targets, and they print like photographs of actual animals on these like big tarps, you know, 4x8 tarps, and we'll put those out there, and we size them differently. So you'll actually see a moose or a muley or an audad or a kudu, you know, all these different things. We got a bison, and it's a big photo of this thing on these tarps. So you find the animal, and then we hang steel over the vitals. Got to hit the steel. So those are a lot of fun. We did that in the beginning of June, mid-June, and we had 34 shooters this year. Had about $40,000 on the prize table from sponsors. So the winner left with a Seekins Havoc PH2 rifle.
Way nice. Cool. What was the winning, 100% kill rate on the shots, the winner?
No. So I still have it challenging enough that even the winner, nobody's cleared the stage in 4 years, complete clear thing. So 29 hits out of 32 was the winning hit this year, hit number. 30 was last year, but we've never had anybody clean it. So I think we got it right there in a sweet spot of difficulty and also challenging and fun.
Is there a scenario that trips people up more than any other? Like, is there consistently one target guys always screw up?
Usually standing. It's amazing how many people don't practice a standing offhand. If I ask you the question, what is long-range shooting? How far is long-range shooting? And usually people will give you a number. What would that be for you?
Oh, it all depends on what I've, if I'm on a bipod that's loaded, flat surf, like, yeah. No, it all depends on what I'm doing.
It's relevant to the situation you find yourself in.
100%.
The condition you find yourself in with your heart rate and what position can you build. So 85 to 100-yard shot on a javelina or a boar at that one with about a 6-inch steel disc on that. That's a tough shot, and that's a long shot for a standing offhand shot. Then you might be doing 150 beats a minute, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, whoa. And that one's probably had the lowest percentage of hits coming out of there, probably low teens, mid-teens on that one, just based on people don't practice that type of stuff. If you can get prone, you get a lot of distance. But we put every stage forces you to use some different alternative type of shooting position. You can't get prone on everything. It makes it a lot of fun, and we feed a big lunch, burgers, hot dogs. We have some tri-tip and chicken wings out there this year, too. And if you finish, dead last, you still leave with probably $400 off the prize table worth of gear.
Oh, that's awesome. What's your advice for the standing? I mean, I could get on my soapbox and talk about wrapping the sling and digging that elbow, like, just below the ribs into your hip. Everybody's got their tricks and tips. What do you tell people for that standing position?
So standing, and almost in anything when it comes to shooting and shooting at distance, we talk about stability and then accepting a certain amount of movement. Like, accept the wobble because it's going to move. So if I know I've got a 20-inch heart and lung field, I got to get it in there. You know, I accept that I can move 15 inches of that, right? I'm not trying to go dead nuts. I got to put it on this hair because then we usually anticipate the shot and so on. So we are always encouraging stability. Except that there's going to be some movement where we're trying to minimize it as much as possible. It's not going to always be dead still. So we are massive advocates of bags. So we actually have a local dude here, Anthony, Reno Rifle Company, and he is a retired deputy fire chief out of the area and loves to hunt, and he is building shooting bags, right? These bags, lightweight bags that you can take with you on a hunt, and they are amazing. And there's a lot of companies out there doing it. This is a local dude that once I met him, like, awesome, I'm using your stuff. You're making great products. You're a local dude. I want to support you. So he makes this one called the Triple Bravo, and it's this big, super lightweight bag. And what I would do in that standing position, instead of trying to just get all awkward and wonky and try to dig that elbow in, I throw that bag in between my body and my arm, and it just deadens everything out and really helps stabilize the gun, and I minimize a lot of that wobble and movement.
Like in between your chest and like your tricep on your trigger hand?
On your
support hand?
Yeah.
Oh, so okay. Support hand. Okay.
Keep my trigger hand, control hand, elbow tight against my body, and then when I bring that the support hand up and out onto the stock, I'll drive that elbow. So like from the back of my elbow back to the bottom of my tricep into the bag, and that bag is in between my body and my arm. But it's probably like 6-8 inches wide. So instead of really having to tweak myself, I just dig it into this super lightweight bag.
That's
and it
cool.
just helps like stabilize everything out. And that's a trick that I use that I don't see a lot of people doing. And I can use that same bag to put on a rock outcrop, throw my stock across it, and keep that stock from riding, stock to rock and getting a ton of movement there. So if you don't shoot with bags or hunt with bags, you absolutely should. for the weight, and they're extremely lightweight. You can get different fills and everything, and he does all that. RenoRifle.com is his website. Like I said, local dude, awesome guy.
Yeah, I might have to grab some of those for the antelope hunt.
Yeah, no kidding.
I need every advantage I can get.
Yeah, and they're lightweight, so it's got this little strap on it, and you freaking just hook it to your kit, throw it on, on your hand, and just always have it with me. And you can use it for a support bag in the rear. You can put it in the front, and it's amazing how much stability you can get from these small, lightweight pieces of accessories that we always hunt with. We took a bag to Africa and Mozambique with us. Always have a bag. The value and how much it provides you in support extends way beyond the inconvenience of this big, lightweight bag you've got with you.
It's really got to help with your confidence, that being comfortable in the shot. You got that brain going, okay, I can do this. I got this. And that confidence gets built.
You were confident at 400. Now it's like 600, right? So now you're able to make higher probability first round hits, and you've extended your capabilities a couple hundred more yards. You still got to walk over there and get it.
That's the kicker. It doesn't matter how far you shoot it. You still got to go and get it.
Yeah.
You still got to go get it.
Yeah.
That's a fact. What do you see as like the most common, we talked about the 270. I like the 270.
Yeah.
What do you see now being like that kind of ubiquitous cartridge everybody shows up to your courses with, or is it just all over the map?
I would say majority of the people showing up are running 6.5s or 300s. Those seem to be the two major cartridges coming in the class, whether it be a 6.5 Creed and or 6.5 PRC. And to, help thwart some of the myths on there of being able to hunt an elk with a 6.5, you absolutely can. Now, you need to manage those distances, but they're still having terminal ballistics beyond 1,000 yards, well above what you need to kill. But people think, you can't do that. I can attest to you. I've watched my wife dump a bull elk at 570 yards with a 6.5 and dropped him like where he stood. It's a lot of its placement, right? I don't even say a lot of it. You got enough muzzle velocity or velocity on that bullet to make it expand the way it's supposed to on penetration. Placement is everything. And I tell people in my class, if you shoot a bull elk with a 50 cal in the ass, you're not killing it. You're tearing him up.
Yeah.
But your placement's horrible. You're this monster round. So if you have more gun than you can handle and you cannot hit the shot or see or impact, that might be too much gun for you, or you learn to build your positions better. And these 6.5 calibers are extremely forgiving. Their ballistics capability are extremely high. And a 6.5 PRC, in my opinion, for the average shooter, average build person, is a phenomenal round that you could hunt elk on down with.
Man, I'm interested to hear more about that. And, going back to like P.O. Ackley's book, what was that, 1948 or something? That concept of hydrostatic shock and, them testing those really hot rounds back in the day on mules of all things in the desert. But I'll pick your brain on that stuff when we come back. Thank you to Truck Envy here in Reno for sponsoring the show. It is Nevada Backcountry, and we will be right back on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Hey, if you miss a segment of the show, you can get on Apple Podcasts and look for Nevada Backcountry, or you can go to 991fmtalk.com. All of the previous episodes of the show are there. It is Nevada Backcountry and final segment of the show with Jim Irwin from Shooting Performance Institute down there in Gardnerville. Jim, right before we went to break, I wanted to keep rolling there, but we had to pay for this somehow.
Yeah.
So, you started talking about these rounds. Yeah, exactly. You started talking about these rounds, and as soon as you started talking about that 3,500 feet per second, I brought up P.O. Ackley's book. I think that was one of the most interesting reads, at least for me personally, when it comes to this stuff. He had that whole thing around hydrostatic shock, and he would rather hit even elk-sized game traveling at like 3,000, 3,200 feet per second than at 1,800 feet per second. It sounds like that's kind of what this company G9 is tapping into, and then coupling it with maybe modern advanced bullet design.
Absolutely. The metallurgy and design on that, how they're able to, they're literally pushing a bullet faster, farther, and keeping it stable longer, right? And the better you are at doing that, your shots are way more predictable in their flight pattern, if you go back to the 308s in my days as a sniper in the military, you know, the 308 sniper rifle, well, that thing starts to ballistically diminish in flight around 800 to 900 yards, and then it becomes unpredictable. Now, if I can push that to a mile, any hunt I'm on, I'm not shooting that far, but I guarantee I know the flight path is very predictable in its trajectory through anything I'm going to hunt at. Extremely predictable, which means my come-ups, my shot placement becomes way more accurate. I'm able to hit where I want to put it instead of it destabilizing, tumbling through some of these further distances, and we're getting there with modern bullet design. How can I push this thing further, faster? And then you'll get the guys, which is okay. I've got buddies, we have this argument, or it's not even an argument, more of a debate on what was considered a barrel burner. You've heard this term, barrel burner.
Oh, absolutely,
right?
Yeah. So the nozzler, that's a common insult leveraged at nozzler.
Right, which, cool, you're right, barrel burner. 3,000, the magic number is 3,000 feet per second. Anything beyond 3,000 feet per second is a barrel burner. So I'll ask the generic question to our listeners is, how often do you shoot and how many rounds a year do you shoot? Right.
Yeah. Bingo.
Let's do some quick math. So the average barrel life on a given barrel is 2 seconds. It's like a drag car, right? Engine. Right? It's a 2 second barrel life. It takes about 2/1000ths of a second for a bullet to go from ignition to out the barrel.
I've never heard it framed that way, but yeah, I'm tracking now. Okay.
Right. 2/1000ths of a second. If the average barrel life is 2 seconds, how many rounds do you need to shoot to get through 2 seconds at 2/1000ths of a second per round? Come to one of my classes, you shoot 100 rounds, still haven't touched it, right? And then you go on your hunt, hey, I'm going to confirm my zero, 2 to 3 rounds. So we're at 103 rounds. This is in a year you took a class with me. And then you go on your hunt, first round kill. So you're at 104 rounds. You don't take a class from me again next year, and you go on another hunt, you confirm zero, it's still right there, there's one round, and then you get another round shot. You drop your animal ethically one round. You back it up. Let's just say it's an elk. You want to put another one in it just to confirm. You did 3 rounds that year.
Yeah.
The average, probably close to 1,800 to 2,000 rounds right in there. So your quote-unquote barrel burner gun could literally last you a lifetime. And if you're running some of these higher-end rifle barrels like I do, you know, these proof barrels and stuff, that goes from a quarter-minute or 3/8-inch group to a half-inch group. I have people waiting to buy that barrel from you. That's now starting to open up to half-inch group.
Yeah.
You know, so what are your expectations of this? So to me, that is not even something to consider. That's your NRL, your PRS shooters that are running thousands of rounds a year. Yeah, those guys are going to be burning some barrels. The average hunter and enthusiast will have that gun for 10, 15, 20, maybe never even need to change the barrel. And then if you do, you're in for the cost of a barrel and a little bit of gunsmithing as opposed to buying a whole brand-new rifle. So to me, that's not even an argument anymore because we've come so far with this. More people get damaged through improper cleaning of their rifles than they do through throat erosion, barrel erosion due to ammunition. So I've talked to, you know, the guys at Proof Research, and we've called, me and my team have talked to some other guys, that like owners, builders of barrels, and they get more barrels back due to improper cleaning and marring from rods than they do actual decay of the rifle or the barrel itself. And so we've actually gone away from big, deep cleanings of guns. We don't even do it anymore. I'm not interested in getting out lead or copper out of the gun. I just worry about carbon. I just clean carbon now. Once you've laid that base and it's been shooting and performing, why would you go back to ground zero of removing all that? And this is also confirmed through talking to these barrel manufacturers. They're like, absolutely. Just get rid of the carbon, man. You don't need to worry about all that other stuff. And if you want to, then maybe every 100 rounds, not every other time you shoot the gun. You know, maybe every 100 rounds you might want to do that. But at the end of the day, they see more damage due to improper cleaning. Carbon's the killer, not the lead, not the copper laying down in your barrel.
What do you use to just get the carbon out? What cleaning products are you using?
So I'm actually using, it's called Vortec. It looks like it's got a wild boar on the thing. It's called Vortec Carbon Cleaner. 5-6 patches through the gun, done.
I do every 300. Again, I don't keep a logbook on like a Model 70 or like, I don't keep a logbook on that stuff. But on that 6.5 Creedmoor, I do have a logbook. I log every round I put through it, every 300 rounds. But I might be screwing up because every 300 rounds, I do use like that Montana Extreme Copper Killer. I scrub the barrel back to start. Yeah.
Unnecessary.
Okay.
Yeah, now you're going back to ground zero on what your gun shooting, right? You're like, you just started all over again where it was shooting. It was printing at zero. It was shooting there. I just knocked some carbon out and it just keeps shooting the same thing. And I'll even go as far as like talking with like Todd Hodnett, who is considered like one of the pioneers of the game, you know, and the Horace reticle, the Tremor reticle. This dude is like that guy who is reinvented long range shooting, teaches all the special operations forces, snipers in this technique. And he's like, I clean the barrel every time I pull the trigger. This is coming from a world-class shooter. Right? I don't clean my gun. I clean every time I pull the trigger. I just knock out the carbon.
Right.
With cleaners, we're not trying to take it down to ground zero again and then start over. It's a waste of ammo, waste of money. I shouldn't say it's a waste of ammo, waste of money, because that's some people, that's just what they want to do. It's just not absolutely necessary to do it. And we're getting results. And we're dropping animals, and my shot groups are insanely tight. And I don't clean my guns like I used to.
Hey, so Jim, you'll appreciate this. Sergeant O'Brien, if you were listening, every time you made me clean that M24 after the range and scrub it, and then you would, I used to hate that, man. After every long distance range we would do, I would have to scrub the 24 down to like nothing left. And I knew that my squad leader was wrong. I just didn't have the balls to say it.
We all did it. Because the damn arms room guy, the arms room sergeant, would be all pissed if it was clean. Yeah, it was just like, we have come so far. Guys like G9 Defense, building these modern bullets, the modern PRC, you know, precision rifle cartridges, the 6 ARCS advanced rifle cartridges. The lethality's up there with less bullet. They're traveling farther. They're stabilized longer. They're really highly predictable. So the days of having to use a 375 H&H or 300, these monster cannon rounds, and I still do 300 Norma, you know, but you get into some of these smaller frame shooters, or they're not as dialed into their positions. These 6.5s are just, they're gold, man. They're absolutely gold. It's really fascinating to see the different stuff that could be coming to the classes, but those are the main two we see.
Hey, Jim, why don't you plug the website one more time and then shoot, unless you got anything else.
All right, so I'm Jim Irwin, CEO and owner of Shooting Performance Institute. You can find us at shootingperformanceinstitute.com, and we're right here in Northern Nevada, Minden Gardnerville area.